so we'll get started. So we are now up to what I would call a brand new unit in our exploration of mitzvos, because we've gone basically from the beginning of the Torah through Parshas Mishpatim, which is kind of in the middle of the book of Shmos, covering a good majority of mitzvos mentioned, not all of them, but most of them. Now I want to enter into Parshas Truma in the Torah and Tetzaveh, and those two parshas discuss the building of the Mishkan and all the different clothing of the Kohanim and the Kohen Gadol. So usually we read these parshas, we get to them every single year. There's actually four parshas that deal with it. There's Truma, Tetzaveh, Vayakel, and Pekudeh. And we wonder, so many details, it's so long, it's repeated, what's the point? I mean, we understand there was such a thing that was built called the Mishkan. They built the tabernacle in the desert for the Jews to serve God. We've mitzvah to build the Beis HaMikdash, the temple in Yerushalayim. But why does the Torah go to such a length to describe all the details, all the points, and repeats it over and over again? And a lot of times, if you're actually studying the Parsha, it could be a drag, because, like, you know, it's why am I keep reading all these, you know, measurements and materials, and, you know, it's a very difficult Parsha to study. But I'd like to do, it might take us a few weeks, and we may have to interrupt our program in the middle, but what I'd like to do is discuss the concept of building of the Mishkan, or the temple, the Beis HaMikdash. Discuss why it's so meaningful to Jewish life. What is the symbolism of all the details that are given, both in terms of the building itself and in terms of all the vessels? The Torah describes at length how to build a menorah, how to build the Aron, the Holy Ark, how to build the even that's what the shovels. It talks about the all sorts of spoons, the altars. So each one of these is a lesson on its own. Each one of them has a very deep symbolism, a very deep meaning to it. Why are these the vessels that God deems are fit to be put into His temple? Why not other types of vessels? Why these materials? Why these measurements? Everything has meaning to it. So we can't cover everything. I mean, this could go on for you know, years discussing every single detail. But I'd like to always try to approach overall all different aspects of the temple or the Mishkan, the kelim, the vessels that are used within. And even the garments of the Kohanim. Why these garments? The Kohanim wore four garments. The Kohanim wore eight garments. So what's special about those garments? Why not this type of hat? Why that type of hat? Obviously, it's not random. If God says a Kohen must wear this kind of hat, that hat must have meaning to it. There's a reason why he gets that hat, not a different type of hat. So those are the coming attractions. Hopefully we'll get to. Yes?
Quick question. As a Levi,
yes.
Were the Levis also directed what to wear since they ministered and they cared for the Kohanim?
I don't think they had any special clothing to wear, the Levis. Okay. They had special jobs to do. But in terms of what to wear, I don't think they had any instructions of what to wear. Right. So today we'll start just with the basic, in terms of the mitzvah itself. There is a mitzvah that we must build. It was first told to Moshe to build the Mishkan. That is the portable temple, the tabernacle in the desert. And that mitzvah carries on, and that we have a mitzvah to build the Beis HaMikdash, the temple in Jerusalem. That mitzvah is quoted in the Torah, as it says, Vasuli Mikdash. Hashem says you should collect donations of all sorts of materials, and you should make for me a mikdash, a sanctuary, a temple. V'shachanti v'socham, and I will dwell amongst you. And that's a mitzvah. It's cited. Well, the donations aren't the mitzvah. The mitzvah is the building of the actual temple itself. Right. God tells Moshe, collect donations.
What's the donations of materials?
Materials. And with those materials, you'll use it to build a Mishkan. And the mitzvah is we have to build a Mishkan. And by extension, we find that you build all three mitzvahs to build the temple. There were two temples that were built. There was, you know, the first temple and the second temple were both destroyed. And God willing, we look forward to building the third temple soon, speedily in our days.
Since you mentioned that, does that come when the Mashiach comes, or when does that come?
That's the understanding. The Rambam says Mashiach will come, and he'll be the one to initiate building the temple.
The third temple.
Really? That's what the Rambam says. So I want to discuss the concept of a Mishkan or a temple. As weeks go on, we'll discuss more details about the building. But today we'll discuss, what's the concept of building a temple? What's the purpose of it all? Obviously, you know, we can't contain God in a building. When King Solomon built the first temple, Shlomo HaMelech, he built the first temple. He said, you know, both the heavens and even the upper heavens cannot contain you, and certainly not this house that I built. I mean, certainly we can't contain God in a house. There's no way to build a house for God. God's not physical. God can't be boxed in any way. That was a quote from King Solomon in the Book of Kings, in Malachim, when he built the first temple. He said, certainly even the heavens can't contain you, and certainly not the house that I built can't contain you.
Yeah, but doesn't doesn't Hashem say much earlier, to build a house?
Okay, so we have to understand what how Levites will contain God. But obviously you can't put God into a house. You can't box God in a house. So we have to understand, what is this? God says build a house. So what is the house that we're building for God? The Ramban, Nachmanides, writes a very powerful point. He has an introduction to the book of Shmos. And the book of Shmos is referred to as, we call it in English it's called Exodus, that's the Latin term, which means the book of redemption. That's when we exit Egypt and we're redeemed by God. It's referred to in rabbinic sources as the Sefer HaGeulah, the book of redemption. And the Ramban says, Nachmanides writes, that the whole book is about redemption. So if you read the book of Shmos, it begins with the Jews in Egypt. We have a Parshas Bo, which discusses, the plagues, the Exodus. Next week's Parsha will discuss the splitting of the sea. So after that, the Jews seem to be redeemed. They're free. But the Ramban says, no, they're not redeemed quite yet. The redemption carries on throughout the entire book of Shmos. Why is that? Because the redemption isn't complete until we return ourselves to the level of the patriarchs, of the Avos. And what's that level? That level is the God dwelling in their midst. The patriarchs are known, the rabbis tell us, that their tents were actually dwelling places for God. There was an intense connection with God you'd have in the tents of the patriarchs. And until we bring God back into our midst with that intensity, we haven't been totally redeemed quite yet. So Jews went into Egypt, they fell to very low spiritual levels, some of them succumbed to idolatry, they're redeemed from Egypt, they go to Mount Sinai, get the Torah, but the redemption is not complete until they actually have God's Shekhinah, the Divine Presence, dwelling amongst them once again. So Ramban says that the continuation of the book of Shmos, which is the book of redemption, is the building of the Mishkan, which is creating that place in the center of the Jewish people where God's presence is most keenly felt and most intensely felt. And that's the ideal existence of the Jewish people, is having God in our midst in that way. Now, again, we'll have to discuss more what that means, because we can't box in God, like we said. But the connection to God that came through the temple is a very intense connection. It's a way we can access God in a way which is much more meaningful, much more immediate than other times in other places in the world. The mitzvah itself, halachically, is to build this building based on the specifications given by God. We build it for the purpose of offering sacrifices, the purpose of the pilgrimage on the three different pilgrimage holidays, the Regalim, and also as a gathering place for all the Jews. That's what's written in the Sefer Chinuch. That's what Rambam, Maimonides, seems to imply. That's the purpose of this house in terms of actions. What happens there? What happens there is offerings and the gathering of Jewish people together. That's what happens at this house, at the Beis HaMikdash. The mitzvah, in terms of its laws, is incumbent not upon any individual, but upon the entire Jewish people. Let's call it synagogue dues. So no one person is responsible to pay the dues to support the synagogue. Everyone's supposed to pay their dues. So it's incumbent upon all the members, the people, to pay their dues to the Beis HaMikdash. So we all have to come together and build it. That only applies when the majority of Jews are in the land of Israel. We don't have a majority of Jews in Israel. This mitzvah does not yet apply. Like you mentioned also concerning Shemitah last week. When you have a majority of Jews in Israel, this applies. Specifications of the actual Beis HaMikdash come through prophecy. The Torah tells you specifications for the Mishkan. The Mishkan was temporary. It was built, and it was eventually was destroyed, it was altered, it was etc. When King Solomon built the first temple, the Mishkan was no longer relevant to us. And the first temple's instructions, they came through prophecy. The second temple as well. When the second temple was built, in the days after the Jews were sent into exile to Babylonia, they came back and built the second temple. It was also built through prophecy. Since then, prophecy has ended, and it will be restored in times of Mashiach. But the specifications of each temple are different. The second temple was very different than the first temple. The first temple is different than the Mishkan. But all the specifications come through prophecy. And God will tell us how He wants His Beis HaMikdash built when the time comes. So what's the purpose of this house? How are we supposed to relate to it, the Beis HaMikdash? But why does God want to have a central... nowadays we have lots of little shuls. Everyone has their shul they go to. Everyone can serve God through their own shul.
Did they have little shuls back then?
They may have had shul. Yeah, they had, for davening, they got together to daven. They may have had that. But in terms of a central place where all should gather, why do we need that central place? Why is it that God felt it was important to have a central place where everyone to gather? So we'll try to go through some different approaches you find in the commentaries. The first approach is the Sefer HaChinuch. The Sefer HaChinuch writes that the entire purpose of building a Mishkan or a Beis HaMikdash is it's supposed to direct our hearts towards the service of God. Because we're always very influenced by our actions. If there wasn't a central place to go and let's say experience or encounter God. The Beis HaMikdash was a place of godliness. It was a beautiful, beautiful structure, which we'll discuss. Everyone was just totally focused. The Kohanim, when the Kohanim offered the sacrifices, they had to be totally focused on what they were doing. That's part of the laws of sacrifice. They have to be thinking totally about what they're doing as they're doing it. It's total focus, total devotion. You walk in, it's a gorgeous building. You hear the beautiful music of the Levites. You see the Kohanim doing their service. You see so many Jews there devoted to God. And it's a real-life experience of God. God commanded for us to make a place, as the Sefer HaChinuch calls it, which is totally pure and clean, you know, to the highest level. It was pristine in terms of spirituality, a pristine place. The purpose of it was to purify our minds and to direct our hearts towards God. It's like a bubble. There's a bubble in the world of spirituality. You know, life, you know, as we go through dreams of life, you know, we can lose focus. We fall prey to Yetzer Hara, we fall prey to our own personal desires or lusts or other goals in life. If you gather back into this bubble of the Beis HaMikdash, this world of spirituality, this world of totally God and godliness and sanctity and purity, so that puts us right back on track once again. Everyone had to go there different points during the year, whether to bring a sacrifice, whether for a pilgrimage. When it came to every 7 years, we had the mitzvah of Hakel, where the king would read the Torah to the entire Jewish people. Man, woman, and child were there for Hakel every 7 years. And that was the time where everyone ended up there at some point in their life, at some point in their year usually. Everyone ended up in the Beis HaMikdash. And they would redirect us, refocus us, and let us step into this world of sanctity to focus our life mission back on God once again. Without that, you know, many times where we fall prey to, you know, we fall off course sometimes. But we can't fall off course. We're always heading back to the Beis HaMikdash once again. It clears our minds, refocuses us, and it constantly puts our minds back on God. Just next two practical notes on that point is, number one, the rabbis tell us that even though the Beis HaMikdash is destroyed, the rabbis tell us, Lo'olam lo zaza ha-shechina mikosel maravi. The Shechina, God's divine presence, never left the Western Wall. You know, we all go, hopefully we've been to Israel, as probably most of us or all of us have been to Israel. We have been there at the Kosel, at the Western Wall. And the rabbis tell us, you know, 2,000 years ago, the rabbis wrote down in the Midrash, said that the Shechina, God's divine presence, never left that wall. Even though the temple was gone, but in the Kosel HaMaravi, the Shechina still resides there. So we can't have the full experience of seeing God's temple and seeing the Kohanim and hearing the Levites. We don't have that right now. But there's a way we can tap into the experience a little bit by approaching the wall. And hopefully we all feel some connection and some special feeling when we've ever approached that wall. If you haven't been there, then by all means, everyone should try to go. But, yeah.
Comment. Having just returned from there, and they have an area in the tunnel which is supposed to be the closest area to the original
to the Holy of Holies. Holies. Yeah.
And right. I know I see a lot of ladies davening there. They sit and they daven all hours of the day and night.
Right.
At that very spot, which is noted. Is that what you're in essence relating to also?
I think that's another point in it. But the entire wall itself, we say, has the sanctity still there from the times of the temple itself. Anywhere near the wall.
There's actually a space on the wall in one of the tunnels where it is supposed to be the closest point to the Holy of Holies.
On the other side of the wall. On the
other side they're not in the Holy of Holies.
In
they're
the tunnels.
Closest point.
Yeah.
And the women daven there.
What was your
I was just mentioning it as in a sense supporting it. Well, I only saw the ladies.
That's a good question. Is there a
mekitza
in that spot?
There is not a mekitza.
But the point is the entire wall, the Shechina resides in that wall, you know, still. God's divine presence is still found in that wall, which means that we can have a more intense connection to God at that point than anywhere else in the world. Yeah.
That wall, the second temple, was it Nebuchadnezzar that destroyed the second temple?
The second temple was by the Romans, by Titus.
Titus. Now, why didn't Titus destroy that wall?
That's God. You know, we had to have this remnant. That remnant is there for us. Why did the Arabs destroy the wall in 1948? I mean, the Jordanians built donkey stalls at the wall, but they didn't destroy the wall. They destroyed everything else. I mean, they destroyed all the synagogues, but the wall, they went touch, you know? Yeah.
Isn't it holding up something that the Arabs like?
Well, on the Temple Mount, you have the mosque. Right, but I don't think it's holding it up. I don't think that's a support for
that.
I don't think the mountain will collapse. I don't think. You know, speak to an engineer. But I don't think it's a retaining wall. I think it's just a.
It's not.
Yeah, I don't think it's retaining the mountain.
I don't think it's physically holding up. It was an outer wall. It wasn't really the wall of the temple.
Right.
It was an outer wall around the whole, you know, the whole area. It wasn't the wall.
I think Swiss say maybe some sort of retaining wall for the dirt on the mountain. I don't think it is, but I don't really know. I don't think it is.
There you go.
Oh, this is the spot.
That's the mark.
Yeah, right. Right. I was there once before. It's a, that's that marker.
The marker.
The closest place you get to the Holy of Holies from outside the Temple Mount.
And then, I think this is the lady's job in there.
That's a real picture?
Yeah.
It looks like a painting.
Very good.
I figured I'd amplify your knowledge.
So on one practical note, we still do have that remnant, which we should be able to go to at some point in our lives, hopefully we can all make it there, and feel that connection in some way, and hopefully we do focus ourselves, you know, in some way back on God. And that's one practical note. The other practical note on this point is that the rabbis refer to shuls as a mikdash ma'at, a miniature based on mikdash. And really, in our daily lives, we should view our shul as our bubble. You know, the shul should be a place where we feel sanctity, where we feel connection with God in a more intense way. And we should try to keep it pure and pristine, like Bais HaMikdash. Unfortunately, you know, many times we're subject to talking in shul or doing things in shul which may not, you know, carry that same atmosphere of the Bais HaMikdash. But ultimately, a shul is a mikdash ma'at, a small miniature of the Bais HaMikdash, and we should be able to refocus ourselves and walk into a spiritual bubble to some degree by going into our shuls. That's ideally how a shul should be as well. It's up to us to maintain the atmosphere and maintain the decorum in a shul which will give it that feeling, which unfortunately is a problem many times. But if that can be maintained, the atmosphere could be there, a shul should have that feeling of a temple in a miniature way. It's called a mikdash ma'at, miniature temple.
Ma'at.
Ma'at, yeah. Ma'at means a little bit. You know, ma'at, ma'at, you know, it's a little bit. You know, it's a little temple. That's what it is.
Yeah, right.
It's mikdash ma'at. I don't know why it's one of those. I'm not sure. That's an interesting point.
Maybe it means ma'at because it means like a part of it.
Ma'at means little, usually in terms of quantity. Katan means in terms of size.
Oh, okay.
So maybe that the quantity of Shechina in the shul is a smaller quantity than Bais HaMikdash, but you still have God's presence in the shul as well. That could be. But that's the there's actually a fascinating midrash. It says that when the temple was destroyed, so the dirt of the temple is scattered around the world. So wherever there's a shul or a Bais Midrash built, it's built on the dirt of the temple. So whether it's literal or figurative, the point is the same point, that the holiness of the temple could be found in a shul or in a Bais Midrash, in a study hall of Torah. So that there's a midrash that says a concept like that. So we can think of it even as a metaphor, but the point is that the dirt of the temple, the holiness of the temple, could be found in every single shul. So that's the approach of the Sefer HaChinuch. Another approach, which isn't new, these are none of the approaches, they all connect to one another. But there's a beautiful approach, which is a metaphor given by the Kuzari. The Kuzari was a famous book by Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, and it was written as a dialogue between the king of the Khazar nation and a rabbi. And the Khazar nation historically was actually a real nation whose king, it's historically verified and confirmed, the king. He interviewed many different religions, and he chose to take on Judaism. And he converted himself to his entire kingdom. And I think for many decades, this was a Jewish kingdom of all converts. And they're looked at as a very noble and moral and ideal kingdom in the East. The Khazar, I think, was somewhere in the Russia area. I'm not sure exactly the location. You can look it up. I mean, it's a historical fact. This work of Rabbi Yehuda Halevi wasn't the actual conversation with the Khazar king. This was his own personal way of portraying ideas. So this is a fictional account that he writes. But the story of the Khazar king is an actual historical account. But this book, Kuzari, is a fictional account, but it is his way of trying to express his ideas in terms of Jewish philosophy.
Kuzari?
Kuzari, it's called. K-U-Z-A-R-I. But the Khazar kingdom, I think it's spelled K-H-A-Z-A-R in English, so the Khazar kingdom.
When was this book written?
The Kuzari?
The Kuzari,
1413? That was probably I would guess the 1300s, my guess. I don't know the exact, that somewhere in that area, I'm not sure.
The expulsion.
First expulsion from Spain.
Yeah.
I think so. There's actually a very interesting story of there was a Spanish Jew who was really one of the leaders of Spanish Jewry. His name was Chistai Ibn Shaprut, I think was his name. He was a very wealthy, influential Spanish Jew, a scholar. And he was one of the ministers of Spain at the time. And he was very interested in this Khazar kingdom he heard about. And there's actually a bunch of letters that he wrote to the king of the Khazars back and forth discussing Judaism. And that's an actual historical account. That wasn't a fictional account. So those letters, we actually have those letters you can read. Because he, as a very prominent Jew in Spain, was very interested in this Jewish kingdom out there somewhere in you know, towards the east. So he actually had a correspondence with the king of the Khazars. It's a very interesting historical story, just to, if you're interested to read about it. It's a very interesting account. But anyways, the Khuzari writes another point. And this point is based on the beginning of in the mitzvah itself of building the temple. God says, build for me a temple, and v'shechanti b'socham, and I will dwell amongst you. Because the ultimate goal of the temple, as we said, is that we should have God's divine presence in our midst. So the actual term Shekhinah, I will dwell amongst you, the Shekhinah is a hard to define term. But practically what it would mean is that it's a place where God is felt in a more intense way. There's a more immediate connection to God. And that's the easiest way to understand Shekhinah. It's a dispute amongst the earlier authorities what Shekhinah really means in terms of what the word itself implies. But for our purposes, it means that there's a place where you can connect to God in a much more intense and feel God in a much more tangible way.
Is that the same word we use for the soul?
Shekhinah?
Shekhinah.
No, wait, the Shammah you mean?
I'm thinking about the soul.
Yes, it's Shammah.
Neshama.
No, Neshama.
Oh, yeah, Neshama.
Yeah, you're right.
So the ultimate result is to create a place for the Shekhinah to dwell. That's what we're trying to do. We build a Beis HaMikdash. Because it's a place now where I can go and rendezvous and experience God in a very tangible way. So the Khuzari writes, he gives a very interesting metaphor. He says, you know, the human body we have a physical body, and we have our neshama. You know, we have the spiritual element to us. We have what we call our human mind. And, you know, let's talk about the mind for a second. You know, the brain is a piece of meat. But we would call our minds, we don't look at our mind as a piece of meat. Our mind is something which kind of is higher than our brain. You know, our brain is a piece of flesh. And, you know, our thoughts and our feelings and our emotions, which go through what we call our mind in English, that's kind of, it's in the brain, but it's not the brain. You know, you can't say my thought is my piece of meat in my brain. My thought's something else. Especially the neshama, the actual human soul, that's something which is not physical. It's not really part of my body, but it's in me. The doctor can't open my body and find my soul, but it's there. So it's in the body, it's connected to the body, but it's not part of the body. If somebody, let's say, doesn't eat well, and the person gets very weak and sick, so their mind doesn't work as well. If a person, God forbid, dies, so then the neshama departs from the body. Now the neshama wasn't eating the food. The neshama wasn't supported by that food, but the neshama has to have a body to dwell in. If the body is there and the body is healthy, the neshama dwells in the body. If the body is gone, the neshama leaves the body. But the neshama never was actually eating the food of the body. When I eat my bagel for lunch, my neshama is not eating a bagel. My neshama is just happy to have a healthy body that it can dwell in. But my neshama doesn't get support by the bagel. So his point in that is to say, I understand that the metaphor I'm giving, that your neshama is not, yeah, so you, no, you, let's take our mind. Our mind, you know, our mind doesn't eat food, but if we have a healthy brain, our mind works very well. We can think, we can. If our brain isn't healthy, so then our mind doesn't work as well. I mean, you can use the metaphor in several ways. Hashem bestows the neshama into a healthy body. If the body is unhealthy, then the neshama leaves the body. The Beis HaMikdash is like a body. And God's divine presence, the Shekhinah, in the Beis HaMikdash is like the soul. If the physical Beis HaMikdash is built to the right specifications, is working right, is functioning, the divine presence dwells there. If it's not built correctly, or it's not functioning correctly, the people are not offering the proper karbanos, not bringing the right offerings, the building is not being used in the right way, then the Shekhinah departs. He even says, the offerings, the karbanos, the sacrifices, are referred to the Torah as lachmi. God calls them, this is my bread. What does it mean, my bread? It's the same way our bread maintains our body, so that our neshama can dwell in our body. So the offerings, sacrifices, maintain the Beis HaMikdash, so that the Shekhinah can dwell in the Beis HaMikdash. The vessels in the Beis HaMikdash, he says, are kind of like our vital organs. If our heart's not functioning right, again, our neshama leaves our body. If the vessels are being used right, the Shekhinah dwells in the Beis HaMikdash. He says that's the metaphor. So the whole physical building, both the offerings brought, both the vessels inside, that's all to create a functioning body, a healthy body. Once that healthy body is there and the structure is, you have the infrastructure of a healthy Beis HaMikdash, then God's Shekhinah dwells. The rabbis tell us that as the Jews started sinning and became more corrupt, so God's divine presence slowly, in 10 different steps, the Gemara says, removed itself from the Beis HaMikdash. You know, a little bit higher, until the divine presence was gone from that area. Except, I guess, the Western Wall. But that's the because that's going to stay there forever. But the idea that Kuzari writes is that when we have to build this structure, we're trying to build the correct structure that can be the container for the divine presence. And if the container isn't working right, then the divine presence leaves. If our body doesn't work right, our neshama leaves. That's the Kuzari writes. I think you could say that. The Torah says that it kind of, we talked about this a few months back, a non-kosher food could clog a person, spiritually. You know, it can cause a spiritual clog, and that you can't connect in the same way as your neshama. I think you could certainly say such a thing. Additionally, another commentary in the Akedah, he writes that, you know, the point of the Shekhinah dwelling in Beis HaMikdash is this central difference you find between the Jewish religion and the ability of non-Jews to connect to God. He says that when we build the Beis HaMikdash in our midst, and we have God dwelling amongst us, he says you can make a metaphor to a husband and wife. So you can have a normal husband-wife relationship where they live together, they support each other, they help each other out. It's a very intimate relationship. There could be a relationship where, you know, the wife lives in one house, the husband's always away, and he sends her packages, he supports her, you know, he provides for her all her needs, but they never actually have any intimate relationship because he's never there. So both wives, you know, have the needs that they're required to live, but one has a relationship with her husband and one doesn't. He says that the Beis HaMikdash represents that we have an intimate relationship with God, similar to husband and wife in a healthy, normal relationship with living with one another. Because there's an intimacy which is there, and a love and a relationship which is there, which you don't find if, let's say, the husband is just sending care packages to his wife. So he says that this is, the Torah tells us, who is the great nation that has God close to them as we are, that God is close to all who call to him. And that's a verse you find in the book of Devarim. And the Mishkan and the Beis HaMikdash shows that we have a real active relationship with God rather than just God providing our needs. God supports the entire world. But the intimacy, the closeness that the Jew can achieve goes far beyond the rest of the world. And the symbol of that is the Shekhinah found in the Beis HaMikdash. That divine presence there means that God is there with us. An interesting point. The Holy of Holies, which is the deepest, you know, the most holy room in the Beis HaMikdash, it's actually referred to as a bedroom in the prophets. And they're talking about intimacy with a husband and wife, that metaphor carries on even to that extent. And there's a place where the most intimate connection happens. It's called, that's the Holy of Holies. So we'll talk about the Holy of Holies, I guess, in future weeks. But that's this concept, this metaphor of husband and wife. The book of the Song of Songs, Shir Shirim, is an entire book of Tanakh that's a metaphor of God and his people as being husband and wife, and a loving relationship. And they depart and they come back together, but there's intimacy which is involved, which is alluded to in the Beis HaMikdash, because God dwells within us, amongst us.
Yeah, but the Holy of Holies is only one person that goes in there.
We'll talk about, let's go there, well, future weeks we'll get there. We'll get there yet.
Yeah, but not everybody can go in the Holy of Holies.
We'll talk about that hopefully in a week or two. But that's a room itself represents. And the Kuzari, if you go back into the Kuzari and read that section where he writes about the Beis HaMikdash, he says, you know, when he describes the Beis HaMikdash as being, you know, like our heart and our soul, and that the divine presence dwells because it's similar to a body. So the king asks the rabbi, the king asks him, well, if that's the case, the Beis HaMikdash is sort of essential to you, so nowadays that means you're a dead people, because it's destroyed. You know, if you take a person and tear out their heart, so what's left of the person? So when there's no holy temple anymore, and we don't have that, as we're saying, the metaphor is that is the heart of the Jewish people. That's what allows us to have a healthy body that God can dwell within. So what happens now? So then the rabbi tells him, you're 100% right. You know, but basically what we are now is it's a bunch of scattered bones, he writes. But there is one flicker of life left within it, and if there's a little bit of life left in a person, you can revive the person. That's what he writes. So we still can be revived. But he says that we have a problem that we never lived with the Beis HaMikdash. We never lived in that time period. We don't know what it's like. We've removed 2,000 years from it now. So we don't understand what Jewish life was like back then. But that was our heart and soul. That's what it was all about. And that's something which we don't have, and we are scattered bones, he writes. But there is still that glimmer of life within us, and then we can rebuild from that. That's what the Kuzari writes. The Ramban, it's actually, if you read it, it's a very beautiful poetic, you know, metaphor that he gives. I mean, the whole book is. I've never read the entire book, but it's a really incredible work. Just in terms of just the beauty, the poetry, the philosophy within it. It's a very important work. The Ramban Nachmanides writes an additional point. He says that the Jews all stood in Mount Sinai and they experienced revelation from God. That was, you know, when we got the Torah. That same revelation, the Shekhinah which dwelled in Mount Sinai, that will constantly dwell amongst them in a more subtle way in the Beis HaMikdash. So it's as if the Beis HaMikdash is a continuing revelation of Mount Sinai. At Mount Sinai, we all stood the mountain and experienced God. So we were able to can that experience, put the experience into the Mishkan or to the Beis HaMikdash, and every time we walked there, we'd be able to experience what it was like in Mount Sinai. That's what the Ramban writes. So that closeness that we had to God in Mount Sinai, the feeling, the revelation, the beauty of Mount Sinai, that could always be accessed through the Holy Temple, through the Beis HaMikdash, the Mishkan. So it's kind of like canning the experience and putting it there for eternity. And the Ramban actually has a long piece that I'm not going to talk about right now, but he actually compares a lot of the different verses describing the Beis HaMikdash with verses describing Mount Sinai. Shows a lot of connections between the two. Because that experience of revelation can be found, as he says, Benister, can be found in a more subtle way, but that can be found in a subtle way in the Mishkan itself. That's Ramban's take on the building of the Beis HaMikdash and Mishkan, ongoing Mount Sinai experience for all eternity. That's what it was for.
What about the place of the learning of Torah? Even though we don't have it, you know, the Holy Temple, and we have the local shuls, we still have something that was given on Sinai, which we can do Torah learning, and we can experience some kind of closeness through that.
There's a lot of ways to experience closeness, but this level of Shekhinah is something which is much harder to access. This is a different level. The closeness to God comes through Torah, study, through mitzvahs, through any act we do for God, it brings us closeness to God. But no, there's different levels. Yeah. And the Beis HaMikdash was the most intense experience. Shekhinah dwells, wherever Shekhinah dwells is a more intense experience. It says that, and if it says studying Torah, Shekhinah dwells amongst those who study Torah. I mean, the rabbis do say things like that as well. But a location like a Beis HaMikdash, that location is what we're discussing, with that intensity. But the rabbis say that anytime you have Jews sitting around studying Torah, the Shekhinah dwells amongst them. There's a way to access God in a more intense manner at those times and places.
Especially in the yeshiva, greater.
Yeah.
Especially when you have 10
men. Yeah, the idea of a minion, right? The idea of a minion also brings Shekhinah in a more intense way. So there's four parashas that discuss the building of the Mishkan here. It's Truma, Tetzaveh, Yom Pekudei. They all discuss that. It's the central point of the Jewish people. That's why it's discussed. It's away from the Torah. But it's very far from us. We don't relate to it. So we're trying to relate to it more. But the Torah spends a lot of time discussing these things because it's such a central point. It's such the idea of Shekhinah, the idea of having this place to access God, a focal point for the entire Jewish people, is such an important experience. The Torah discusses all details at length. Rabbi Hirsch writes, Rabbi Shishofal Hirsch writes, that if this is going to be the building that's going to contain the Shekhinah, so that means that every single nuance of the building teaches us how we can bring Shekhinah into our lives. And as we study these parshas in a more detailed way, we can take lessons from that. How does that bring Shekhinah into my own personal life? The way we can relate, a lot of commentaries discuss that studying the ideas of the Mishkan or Beis HaMikdash, that gives us a connection even after the destruction. So the Torah is eternal. Even if practically we can't go today with the hammer and nails and build a Beis HaMikdash, but as we learn the concepts, we discuss them, we understand their depth and their content, so that makes accessible to us. The concept also when it comes to sacrifices, the offerings. We can't bring sacrifices nowadays, but the rabbis tell us if you recite the paragraphs in the Torah about sacrifices, it's as if you brought the sacrifice. Why? Because if your heart can have the same feelings when you recite it as if you actually did it, so then your heart's still reaching that same exact point that would have been there had you brought the sacrifice. Because ultimately the point of it all is your heart should relate to the ideas, not just the actual action of the sacrifice itself. So nowadays, if we recite the paragraph, understand what we're reciting, and we devote ourselves and our hearts to the concepts as if we're doing it ourselves, that is tantamount to us doing it ourselves, as the rabbis tell us.
Can you identify which paragraph you're referring to exactly?
Well, I mean, there's many, many paragraphs.
I thought there was when you said paragraph. I thought maybe there was one.
Not in any particular one.
Oh,
I mean,
okay, that's fine. That's fine.
If you want to bring a Thanksgiving offering and you recite that paragraph about Thanksgiving offerings, as if you brought the Thanksgiving offering.
Okay,
that's
thank
what it
you.
Is.
Got it. Thank you.
It's called the Neshama Parm Sivasena, that we should repay our cows with our lips. Instead of the cows that we owe as sacrifices, we can use our lips instead. That's a quote from Tanakh. Neshama Parm Sivasena. So the, Rabbeinu Bachaya, one of the earlier, I think he was a Spanish commentator, he writes that there's a verse in Tehillim, it's in Psalms 48. It says, one should circle Zion and walk around, count its towers, strengthen its palaces, etc. And he says, what does it mean we should circle Zion? This doesn't mean physically walk around Jerusalem. It means as we think about Jerusalem, as we understand the concept of Jerusalem, as we understand the palaces within, the Beit Hamikdash itself, that itself is our way of circling Jerusalem. And that's our way of relating to the concepts of the Beis Hamikdash even after the destruction. There's many commentaries point out that the verse when it says, build a Beis Hamikdash, vasu l'mikdash, make for me a mikdash, v'shechanti besocham, and I'll dwell amongst you. So they say that the final goal is that the Shekhinah should dwell not only in the building, but in every single Jew. Because we have to make ourselves also into our own personal temple. Our body, our neshama is our temple for God. That's a place where the Shekhinah can dwell. And every Jew, as they work on themselves and become better people, so it's not just that that God dwells in the temple. We want God to dwell in every single Jew. Every single Jew could also become a temple for God as well. That's what we're trying to get to with any Torah, all Torah and all mitzvahs. The idea is to sanctify the Jewish person that God could dwell within them. That's what we're always trying to reach throughout all these discussions. So God willing, in the next few weeks, we'll discuss more details of the building, we'll discuss concepts of the actual vessels, we'll discuss the clothing of the Kohanim, and to understand that every single detail is so important, because this is what it takes to make a dwelling place for God, so that's our concept. Every single, just like there was an ark in the temple, we're going to understand what an ark means for us. Just like there was a menorah in the temple, what does a menorah mean for us? Just like there was, the Kohen wore a certain type of hat, what does that mean for us? We'll try to discuss what it means for us, every single one of those details. Commentaries go to the point to discuss why was it that the measurement of the Aron was 1.5 tefachim. That's a certain measurement. Why is that the measurement of it? Why was it made out of gold, not out of silver? Why are things made out of silver, not out of gold? Every single detail matters. But that's all coming down to the point that this is going to be the physical dwelling place for the divine presence, and therefore it has to be built to the right specifications. It's like if an engineer is off by a single centimeter, the bridge collapses, that type of thing. So we have to have it exactly as it's supposed to be so that we can have the Shekhinah dwelling there. If we don't have the exact specifications for the Shekhinah, then the Shekhinah does not dwell there.
One thing I find interesting compared to modern day society, the Hashem, the Supreme Being, he calls out the requirements for his dwelling. Or if the people don't exactly do, then Hashem is not going to come down and dwell. This is a very foreign from today's society. People are, I think I'll do it my way, and let's not do it that way, let's do it this way. Where in the Torah, it's very specific that it has to be, the beings have to be this long.
Right.
And everything, the people were very exacting in the way that they, built the Mishkan in the desert. But this is such a foreign idea for that. It's like, we don't have to do it that way. We can,
It's a very important point.
Some people made that up anyway, and whatever.
We'll just finish with that point. The two sons of Aaron, not of an Avihu, so they walked into the Holy of Holies to bring an offering, and they were killed. It was during the dedication of the Mishkan, they were killed. And the problem they did, the rabbis tell us they were very holy people. They had the best intentions in the world. What they were doing was beautiful. The problem was, the Torah says, they offered a fire that God did not command them to offer. That's what the Torah says. Because as good as our intentions are, if it's something that God doesn't want, that does not bring holiness. You could be the most righteous person in the world and have the greatest of intentions, but if this isn't what God commanded, so then that's not what God wants. God says, the way you connect with me is as I tell you to. It's not as you think you should do. It's as I tell you to. You find many examples like that. But that is, every single step of the Mishkan, as it was built, it always says that Moshe did as God commanded. because the Moshe did something, even one slight, slight bit off, that went to brought God's presence into the Mishkan. That's exactly as God commanded, or else there's no divine presence in the Mishkan itself. So yeah, that is, I think that is a very relevant and important point to make. Any other questions?